Okay, so this is a bit of a monster session today, but there'll be lots of debate time, so you'll all get a chance to speak, really. My name's Siobhan, and I'm going to be chairing this session. We've got speaking today Gavin Bell, who'll be speaking about real-time web versus persistence. Gary Gale, who'll be talking about location, privacy, and opting in and out. And finally, Gavin Starks, who'll be talking about your energy identity. And we're going to let each speaker speak for about 15 minutes and then open the floor for questions, short questions that can feed back to the panel. And then we'll have an extended session for comments and debate before letting the panelists round up again at the end. So without further ado, I'll pass over to Gavin Bell to talk about real-time web versus persistence.
Hello, everybody. Okay, so this is me trying to understand what I want from the web in kind of 5 years' time. And I'm sort of projecting myself forward 5 years and looking back to the web of now and thinking, is the web of now representing my identity online or representing my activities online the one I want to be looking back in 5 years' time? So forgive me if this is a bit of an intellectual exercise. Okay, so what's the real-time web made from? Well, it's made from millions of Twitter messages, billions of photographs on Flickr and services like that. We're kind of self-documenting our lives online. It's a picture from my three-year-old's birthday. We're annotating our lives. This is writing a talk last night. Providing annotation on what we do and sharing it with other people. And we're doing it in real time. I mean, who can want for anything more than that? Okay. So we're kind of... There's a Philip K. Dick novel entitled We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, which turned into the film Total Recall very, very loosely, as most adaptations seem to go. This seems to be the offer that's on, it seems to be what's on offer from many companies. Kind of. I don't think we want to drown in information. How many newspapers have you bought in the last year? Sorry. How many newspapers have you bought in the last year? 52. Have you kept any of them? Okay. Have you kept all of them? Okay. So we're quite happy with the idea of throwing away information. We recycle books. We give them away to other people. We don't need to keep everything that we put online. Okay. Thank you. We don't need to keep everything that we put online forever and ever and ever. So there's an issue of kind of, are we building a real-time web or a kind of near-time web? And two companies, Twitter and Flickr, take different opinions on how we should build these kind of services. So with Twitter, I think you can go back about 3,500 messages. They've changed the interface recently so that it focuses very much on the kind of the real-time aspect of it. Flickr took a different opinion. They offer all of your pictures back to the day you started and every single piece of social interaction that you've been involved with back to the day you started, but they don't offer a personalized real-time feed of that content. There are different engineering trade-offs involved in building these different kinds of systems. Facebook recently moved from a deliberately lossy approach in providing your news story feed to one which is 100%. It's a significant engineering effort behind providing that as well. So what about the past? Is the past the same as today? I don't think it is. I don't think it should be. We don't actually remember every single detail. I was here at this event last year and right the way back to NotCon 04. I don't remember the specific details of what happened on every single one of those days, but I do remember significant things that happened in the past. This is the first picture I ever put on the web. That's about the size it was. It was taken with a Quicktake 150. It's from 1995. It's a picture of my school. I can vaguely remember the day I took it, but not what I ate or what I was wearing. I remember it was a sunny day. Will I want a Twitter-like archiving service that contains all of the details of what I've done on a kind of day-by-day basis that I've made public? Going back 14 years, if Twitter extended extended the service they provide? I'm not sure. There are real benefits in forgetting. There's a book by Gerd Gigerenzer, the name of which escapes me. Can someone help? Called... No, it's gone completely. Anyway, in which he describes a Russian reporter called Sheravedsky, who could remember everything verbatim. His memory is absolutely incredible. He could remember strings of 70 words given to him. Most people can do about 7 or 8. He was also able to recall details of a meeting from 15 years earlier in absolute clarity. What people wore, what the weather was, what time they met, what they discussed. He was even able to remember the word strings that the psychologist who was assessing him gave him from 15 years ago, exactly perfectly, 70 words. But while he had terrific recall, his ability to perform abstract reasoning was appalling. If you gave him a book to read, he could tell you every single detail about the book, but he couldn't summarize the plot. So there are strong benefits to our brains in terms of that our brains provide us in terms of forgetting details of things. We remember significant activities. We don't remember every single tiny trivial detail because our brains aren't designed to work that way. We remember the stuff that matters. We chunk things together. We remember some specifics, but not the entire thing. So what should we forget? The human brain also operates with a kind of sensory store. And the sensory store is an interesting object. There's an echoic one, there's a visual one and an auditory one. Generally, they throw away most of the information they receive within seconds of processing it. But what does this mean on the web? Well, I'll give you two views of Last.fm, and you tell me which one you think is more useful. So this is the artist I've listened to in the last 3 months. This is about a dozen tracks I listened to in 2007. Who prefers the former and who prefers the latter? Hands up for the former. Anybody like the latter one? Okay. It's easy to read. Is that hard to read? Okay. Okay. But this tells much more significant information about me. So I think aggregation is the key to what we need to do with these real-time data feeds. For example, Apple provided a very good automatic creation of events within their iPhoto product recently. As we have digital capture of pictures and we're storing them all on the one machine, it's quite easy to have 5, 10, 25, 35, even 100,000 pictures for some people. Being able to find the right picture, the way our memory works, we also tend not to keyword and tag things appropriately. But we know roughly when something happened. Yeah, it was Jim's wedding last summer, was it June? We do that kind of thing very well, but we don't do a kind of visual search or spend the time methodically keywording every single piece of content. So I think what we need to do is kind of keep the original information, keep all of it, but somehow provide a kind of abstraction service. One way that this is starting to happen is the integration of Flickr pictures into services like Doppler or services like Last.fm or Upcoming. So that we end up with the salient event we went to, the concert or the conference we attended, and the photographs that we took that and our friends took are associated with those events. At the minute, it's done on a very global level. All pictures associated with that Goldfrapp concert are visible on Upcoming or Songkick or whatever music service you like. I'm interested in kind of building personal ones of those. Some kind of technical approaches to building this kind of stuff. HAtom, the microformat, is very useful for actually giving a specific timestamp to an item of content. It generally ignores the timestamp that the page has or the timestamp the web server wants to give you. It specifically embeds the timestamp around the piece of content using the HAtom microformat. Date-based URLs are very good for kind of breaking stuff up. I really wish Twitter had date-based URLs. It would make finding content so much easier. And then we need a means of determining significance. Favoriting is very useful. Replies are useful. And the ability to create sets and collections as Flickr offers. As a quick side point, one of the things that we do is we also forget friends. The people you've added to conferences over the last five years or so, maybe you don't remember them anymore. It was a very salient relationship at the time. Look back two or three years later, you've no idea who they were. So our social tools should help us prune our social networks, our social relationships. This is starting to happen on LinkedIn and other tools, but we need to recognize that we're not caddisfly larvae. We don't kind of bring everything with us everywhere. The one thing that's interesting from the teenage models that are being examined on MySpace by people like Dana Boyd are this kind of renewal of identity. As teenagers go through years of school, they will move from Bebo to MySpace to whatever is the new social service and throw away the account from the previous year and start their friendship networks afresh. Once we enter our 20s and start working in professional environments, it's much harder for us to do this kind of thing. So a quick reprise. What might we want from social applications in the future is what I'm after. My Flickr stream of 2 years ago is somewhat useful. My Twitter stream is not so much. I want a means of finding the significant events for me and from my friends. I think this is something also that newspapers should be doing. How do you know what was interesting that happened in the UK 3 months ago? You can find the detailed stories, but can you find an overview of what happened 3 months ago that was relevant? So to pick up on the Philip K. Dick from earlier, I kind of want an abstracting for his wholesale approach. Automatic summarization of my events, of the events that I have generated and my friends have generated, based on the things that happen in the social interactions that happen in that activity stream, the faving, the commenting, the replies. Ideally linked across different applications so I get a composite view of my life. And so there are the planet type aggregation tools have been doing this as special cases with specifically hand-tooled RSS feeds for years and years. I want that for my social life as well. So I mentioned favoriting quite a few times. I think favoriting is a really important thing that social applications can do. I think it's important because it's incredibly lightweight. There's no tag to enter. Generally, the thing is manifested by a single click. But I also mean things like the Doppler have visited and have liked approaches, the delicious add to library, or some applications offer a kind of save for later approach. What we get from these favoriting lists is too often a kind of dumb list of activity. It's just a list of things. On Flickr, it's just a list of, I think, 60 photos a page that friends have liked. There's no breaking up of this. There's no kind of aggregation of which of my friends have favorited these pictures, which tags correspond to the pictures which have been favorited. I'd like to see my favorites and my friends' favorites on a timeline. I'd really like someone to make, or I might make, a kind of BFFFF, a best friends Flickr faves application. It should be trivial to make. The API supports this kind of stuff. Another example from FriendFeed is this kind of bleed through. So this is someone I follow on FriendFeed. A friend of theirs favorited something. If you read the detail, the kind of third line down, it says that one of Cameron's friends favorited this thing. And this is shown in my FriendFeed view of the application. I'm sure most of you have seen this. But this kind of social bleed through. Thank you. So pinching this social atlas term from Doppler, I'd like to see more of these. Last.fm provides them for music. Flickr provides one for photographs in the world. How would the addition of time change these atlas products? What was my favorite music in 2008? What were my friends listening to in 2008? What were popular places that my friends traveled to in this time frame? There's too much focus, I think, in social applications on now and the near future. So what would a Twitter social atlas look like? I hope it would be better than trending. What about one that respected the conversations that I'd had and the social interactions that I'd had? One that respects my kind of the content that my friends have favorited on Twitter and the conversations, the app replies. I should be able to look back 6 months and see what were the kind of relevant, significant conversations that were happening. So I want to provide this kind of, I want to retain a meaningful social context around the content that I produce and my friends produce. A quick example, the Arden edition of Shakespeare, which some of you may know about, it's the best edition of Shakespeare, and it's the best edition because it explains the humor and the language that Shakespeare is written in. It takes you back 400 years to when Shakespeare was written and lets you understand the social context in which the plays were created. A lot of the social context flows past us on our activity streams, but we don't hold on to it. I don't want to end up with a position where we need an Arden for Shakespeare 20, 30 years from now. I think we can get it, but we need to demand these kind of features from the people who make these social products and point them at good examples, so point them at Flickr, point them at what Last.fm are doing, point them at what Doppler are doing, and say, I want this kind of feature for my applications because this is my data and I want you to provide me with tools to help me manage it. So thanks very much. I used these two people's pictures. I've written a book, which comes out in August. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're just passing over the computer there. If anyone standing at the back wants to come forward and take a seat, there's some seats left there. We're passing over now to Gary Gale, who's going to be talking about location, privacy, and opting in, not out. Just pass you the...
Can everybody hear me? Please shout if you can't hear me. Okay, so this is me. I work for a small internet company with a fixation with the colour purple. And I want to talk to you about three things. I want to talk to you about location, I want to talk to you about privacy, and I want to talk to you about the differences between opting in and opting out. So let's talk about mobile phones for a minute. We've all got them. I should imagine we've got a fairly disparate range of handsets and capabilities in the audience this afternoon. Some of them have got GPS, so you can find out where you are, not necessarily in a building like this, but outside on the street with a fair degree of accuracy. All of them are able to work out roughly where they are by triangulating with varying degrees of accuracy with the mast they're getting their signal from. Some of them have even got Wi-Fi. And again, that can be used to triangulate roughly where you are. And this isn't just mobile phones now. There's a great convergence between phones, laptops. You even get cameras now with built-in GPS. Loads of laptops have got this capability as well. The key thing about all of this is the fact that this is a very, very valuable market. It's not just about you knowing where you are. It's about other people knowing where you are as well. Now, admittedly, this particular figure here from Gartner Research was made shortly before the economy went downwards and tanked rapidly, so it will be an interesting experiment to see whether this is still true. But the fact remains that where you are is an immensely valuable piece of information. It's also quite cool. So there's an organization which calls themselves Trend Watching, and at the beginning of this year, they spoke about map mania. Which is the year that all things smartphone, convenience, cell ID, and spontaneity come together in one orgasmic celebration of map-making, no less. So, we've got coolness, we've got value. Let's talk about privacy for a minute, because that's done location. There's this website called Wikipedia, and they've got a reasonably good definition of what privacy is. But before we talk about location and privacy, there's a whole slew of existing areas of your life where the default privacy model that you've got is one where you explicitly have to say you don't want to reveal this information. It's opt out. So, I'm talking about the phone book, the electoral roll, cold call marketing databases, mail shop marketing databases, and also that little who is information, that metadata, which is attached to your personal domain name. Now, hang on a second. Do you really have to manage every single one of these pieces of personal information separately because by default you've opted in? Well, you can opt out by going X directory. You can opt out by ticking that little checkbox on the electoral roll which says, you know what, I don't want my information sold to marketers. This is the telephone preference service. That will stop a vast proportion of people bugging you at 10 o'clock at night and trying to sell you double glazing. There's also the mailing preference service. And again, this will stop a small Amazon rainforest of wood pulp coming through your letterbox on a daily basis. And you can also pay your domain registrar not to reveal your information. But again, you've got to manage this yourself. You've got to opt out. Now, some people don't think this is too much of a problem because Scott McNeely here, the chairman of Sun Microsystems, says, yeah, you've already got zero privacy. Get over it. But I'd like to think that we're moving now towards a model where, especially where location is concerned, where we want to opt in. So let's look at the media for a minute. The Daily Mail, a fine piece of online journalism, I think we can all agree. This was the headlines when Google launched their Latitude application. We know where you are. We're tracking your friends, your family. Well, actually, you're not. Because in order to do that, you've had to explicitly opt in to using the service. Here's providing a nice little counterpoint. Here's where we released Fire Eagle, and the register in their normal tendency to put exclamation marks after everything, still focused on the fact that we know where you are. The actual article is actually quite fair and balanced, but the headline still deals with this sensationalistic big brother, we're tracking you, we know where you are. Metro. Google will spy on workers. Oh, God. And then MPs claiming Google Latitude is a danger to privacy. And as this CNET article quite aptly puts, the irony meter explodes. But there's a big tendency now to come towards a little bit more of a pragmatic approach. So here's the Wall Street Journal. Privacy, we got over it. And you know what? Some people, they don't actually care at all. So you can see that we really need to stop thinking about a default policy of opt-out and start thinking about opt-in, at least where responsible, well-thought-out location services are concerned. Okay, so this is Google Latitude. Apologies for the resolution here. It's really difficult to get a decent screenshot off a BlackBerry. And it's saying, do you want to detect your location? Do you want to set it? More importantly, do you want to hide it? Here's Fire Eagle, Yahoo's location brokerage service. And here's my applications. I'm tuning exactly what it is I want to do on a per application basis. There's quite a few applications. And you know what? I can hide myself. Or alternatively, I can turn around as a user and say, nah, don't want to do that anymore. Get rid of everything. So Fire Eagle has got a WordPress plugin, WordPress, the blogging platform. And the nice thing about this is it's got a particular string in the information that it spits out, which is Fire Eagle last spotted me at. So 2 days ago, I did a web search for just this sort of thing, just to see who's using this and what sort of information is being revealed. Well, that's my blog, so we'll skip over that one. So here we go. We've got somebody who's in Long Mountain, Colorado, blogging about random Ubuntu and Launchpad things. We've got interactive musings from a creative technophile who's in Austin, Texas. We've got ramblings on travel from someone who has said, you know what, I don't want you to know exactly where I am, I just want you to know the country. So he said he's in the United States. And unfortunately, we don't have somebody who said that he was a self-described Apple Kremlinologist and Prince Philip worshipper from New York. That one seems to have vanished off the web, unfortunately. So the thing that I'm hoping you're starting to see here is that it's not about where you are now. It's about where you've been. That is the value. Think of it as a location stream, if you are. You need to write a manifesto in order to determine whether or not you are going to use location services. One's from Yahoo, one's from Google, one's from Microsoft, anybody who is going to take your location and do something with it. So here's some things to bear in mind before you click that little checkbox which says, yes, I'm okay with this. You need to be able to control your data all the time. You need to know what's going on with it. You need to be able to add or remove your permissions. You need to be able to know exactly how it's going to be used. Are they going to big brother you, or is it just going to be for something a little bit more benign? You've got the right to your data remaining secure and not suddenly finding itself on the web in a public data dump. You should be able to control the accuracy and the privacy of your data. This means you need to be able to lie. You need to be able to say either, I'm not here, or actually, I'm somewhere else. Think about this. I use Fire Eagle on my phone every day. I'm a bit of a compulsive Fire Eagle updater, I'm afraid. My boss is also a compulsive Fire Eagle updater. Do I really want to see him reading my location stream and say, Gary is currently in Google's headquarters? It might give the wrong impression. I want to be able to suspend access occasionally. I want to be able to remove it entirely if I want to. at any time. When's convenient for me? Not when it's convenient for the company that's holding the data. I want to know how it's going to be used. And I want to have the right to give only necessary personal and location data. If I'm telling somebody where I am, is my telephone number, my postcode, and the inside leg measurement of my firstborn child really applicable information? So, what else? I want to know how it's stored. I want to know where it's stored. I want to know what you're doing with it. I want to know how long you are going to keep that information for. Be honest with me. Be transparent with me. And finally, it comes back again to lying. I want the ability for my mum not to know I'm out on the piss the third night in a row. And there's a chap called Alfie Denon who founded a mobile blogging site called Moblog. And he came up with this as a Twitter comment, which I think sums it up really neatly. And there comes a point when you realize you're actually not on the web. You're in the web, for better or for worse. So thank you for listening. I hope I haven't put you all to sleep. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're going to pass over to our final speaker, Gavin Starks, who's going to be talking about your energy identity.
Hopefully. Hello. I thought I'd stand up because it's getting to the end of the day and it might be a bit more animated. And also, it's quite dark up here when you're sitting down there, so I thought you can actually see me. I thought I'd start off with a little nice statistic to make you all really cheery, or a few statistics to make you really cheery. So this is your nice, shiny Mac laptops, 2.5 kilos of product. Apple have worked out the entire footprint, including all the production, the marketing, all of the transport, the usage, and the waste components of that. And it translates roughly to half a ton of CO2. Just to give you an idea, and obviously it ends up in landfill most times as well. Just to give you an idea of the scale, that little red dot there is your 2.5 kilos, and proportionally, that's your roughly half a ton of emissions related to that. To put some context around this, the Stern report estimated that the sort of average sustainable emissions per annum per person for a 6 billion person population is about 2 tons per annum. So how comfortable would you be about spending a quarter of your annual allocation on a Mac, given that, you know, a long-haul flight is actually 2 tons? The average footprint in the UK is about 10 tons. The average footprint in the US is about 20 tons. So, you know, we've got some fairly order of magnitude issues around here. My name's Gavin Starks. I'm the founder and chief exec of a company called AIMEE. We've got some fairly ambitious plans and targets we've been running through. Just to give you an idea, we're here to try and map, measure, and track all of the consumption, all of the activity data on Earth, which is a nice small challenge, and then calculate the carbon footprint of everything on Earth and its environmental footprint. I'll come on to why we think this is a good idea in a minute, but very, very much building on what's been talked about already, we want to enable data portability around this and enable everyone and everything to have an environmental intelligence built into it, because we're facing some fairly serious issues. Just to give you a quick idea of the kind of range of people that we're working with at the moment, we work with UK government through to, who here uses Doppler? A lot of people. So if you see the Your Carbon tab on Doppler, that's us. We're just executed up to the API level. We don't do any front-end stuff. We work with everyone, basically, from Morgan Stanley to Google to Radiohead. And over the last couple of years, we've sent out over 500 API keys, and we've got about 1.5 million profiles in the platform of footprints of either individuals or households or businesses. So why are we doing this? Well, we're facing some fairly big issues. We're not just hitting peak oil. Even Shell and Exxon are now coming out and saying, oh, peak oil, probably 2015. We've seen that we've hit peak finance. We're seeing that we're hitting peak water, and peak water scarcity is a real good indicator as to the initial effects of some of the climate change things that we're expecting to see. There's also other kind of things that are not so visible, like if we were to switch all of our energy production to nuclear, we'd run out of uranium in about 3 to 5 years. We've estimated got sort of 20, 30 years left of copper before we have to start really properly recycling all of the stuff that we're using. So we're hitting this kind of peak resource thing. So that's kind of peak consumption. And you could apply that to everything from our GDP to the resources that we're mining, etc. So there's some fairly heavyweight issues. And of course, they're all nicely framed for us with the whole carbon debate. So you've got MIT coming out and saying, actually, it's much, much worse than we thought. The range, the estimated range now for global warming is between sort of 4 degrees and 9 degrees, actually. Even this stat is slightly out of date now, but it's over 5 degrees as the median. And given that we all kind of thought that 2 degrees was roughly the tipping point for mass extinction events, 5 degrees is quite a dark place. But you can get darker as well. So if you look at Lovelock's quote, he thinks that by the end of this century, we'll be lucky if there's a billion people left, which gets us into a fairly dark space. But it can get even darker. Hansen's come out and said that, and he's the head guy at NASA looking at this, that if we burn all tar shale, which is what is currently happening and the US is running away with at the moment, then we could end up with the Venus syndrome, which is where the upper atmosphere just blows away and we turn into Venus. So it kind of redefines mass extinction event a little bit there. So now we've done all the kind of dark stuff. I like building people down in a really dark place. What do we do about that? So as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at a scenario where even to sustain a 6 billion population, we're meant to be reducing our footprint by roughly an order of magnitude. So how are we going to reduce our consumption and our energy consumption by 90%? It's not a small challenge, it's quite a big challenge. So you've got policy coming. You've got the UK Climate Change Act. In the US, the White House has said that they'll have carbon as part of the US budget by 2011, which is it's quite soon. The Waxman Bill, which is the US equivalent to the Climate Change Act, passed the first hurdle the other week. So that's kind of moving forward, but none of the targets are kind of 50% maybe by 2050, which are massive targets, or 80% by 2080. But if you listen to the chairman of the IPCC, the International Panel of Climate Change, recent Nobel Prize winners with Al Gore, they're now saying we've got about 6 years to fix this, which is a very, very short time frame indeed. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to help bring together a lot of the information around this, because we're still at a very information scarce place right now. Most people don't have any idea, and I mean every single tier, don't really have the information they need to make decisions. They don't really have, we're not really at a point where we're measuring properly. And if you can't do any of that, you can't do anything else further down the chain in terms of engagement, in terms of systemic change. So we're looking at all of the data. We're looking at policy data, all the way down the tree through legislation, frameworks, exchanges, right the way down to trade. And to give you an idea of that, if just within the EU, you've got the various kind of Kyoto Protocol, trading schemes, etc., the UK Climate Change Act. Just wanted to pick out one in particular which is affecting us in the UK. So one of the outputs of the UK Climate Change Act is this thing called the Carbon Reduction Commitment, which is currently in consultation, but due to be executed next year. And that will affect any company that spends more than £500,000 on electricity, which is about 3,000 or 4,000 companies in the UK. Now, the impact of that is you're meant to do 30-minute monitoring of your electricity, which implies that you have to have some technology that will do that, which a lot of companies now are working on. And you have mandatory payments that are associated with that. So it's a minimum spend of about £70,000 or £80,000 per annum. So starting sort of next year and building up, there'll probably be a £600 million a year market around this particular legislative instrument, which is actually incredibly gameable and probably won't lead to that much change because of the way it's structured. So you need to kind of take all of that and build it into, you know, how's that going to affect everything else? So how are we going to measure all of us, all the things that we have, looking into the private sector and the public sector, looking at cities and countries, because this is a global issue, you know. How do we get China and the US and Russia? There's a stat came out just yesterday that Russia, the World Bank came out and said with a reasonable amount of investment, Russia could probably have half its energy consumption within 3 to 4 years because of the way that they're currently using energy and producing things. So there are kind of some fairly systemic changes there. They need to be really driven at every level of society. And when we talk about all of the data, and when you dig into environmental assessment, you end up measuring everything. And it's very like kind of the early web days where you kind of stick your hand up and say, oh, we do things with carbon. And everybody goes, yeah, we want a carbon thing. And you go, well, yes, that's very good. What do you actually want? Well, we're not really sure. It's a bit like saying, you know, we want a website. And great. So what we're looking at enabling the data capture of is everything you purchase, all the materials, all the buildings data, so square footage, transmission factors of the glass, the heating systems, insulation, etc., all of your fuel bills, all of your waste, all of the water, and all of this data collectively we've started to kind of phrase as your energy identity. It's very akin to your digital identity in the online space, but it completely breaks into the physical space. And as I've shown, there's already legislation coming which effectively trades on that energy identity. It's only looking at the moment at a very, very narrow set of data around electricity consumption and other key fuel consumption. But that legislation, all of those instruments are moving forward and saying, okay, how do we look at what's called scope one? So that's kind of broad emissions from the energy that you're producing to the electricity, gas, etc. that you're consuming. And then looking into what's called scope three, which is travel products. And as soon as you open that sort of lid, there's just everything is underneath it, every supply chain, everything. So we've been kind of looking at this in some of our work with the UK government, who I have to say have been absolutely spectacular in, to work with, because normally, as you are all very aware, governments publish standards as PDF files, or in some cases, if you're lucky, as a spreadsheet. They actually use AMI as an upstream route to market, effectively a channel for the government standards to do personal carbon footprinting. So that's a lot of people have integrated with AMI just to use that data. And through that, the national campaign, there's a national campaign called Act on CO2. Can I just do a quick check, actually? How many people here have heard of Act on CO2? How many people have filled it in? Okay, a few of you have filled it in. So AMI stores all of your data. Just so you know, we anonymize it on the way in. That's quite important. But we've noticed part of that questionnaire, if you like, is actually quite detailed. It's about 60 questions. How many people are in your home? How old is your television? How many cars have you got? Really detailed information. And so you kind of get to this point where your energy identity is actually has a value, the digital embodiment of your physical consumption, everything that you do. And if you link that into your GPS information, you know, we can tell your mode of transport from your GPS. So if you're going from London to New York in 5 hours, you've definitely taken a plane or magic. But you get such granularity now, you can tell whether it's a train or a car or a bike or an underground, because you disappear and you reappear, you know, those kind of things. So you start to get all these systems coming together which are revealing more and more about what you do, and that can be used to measure your footprint. It's all very good. So, you know, we can do some measuring, some mapping, and some analysis. But actually, you know, when you look at, say, just that last figure, which was the $8 billion on just your location data, well, this is incredibly valuable stuff. So shouldn't your energy identity be more valuable than your digital identity, and how might we protect it? So one of the points here is that it's not just our consumption data that's changing, it's the way that energy is produced is changing. I don't know how many people here have got solar panels or wind farm or looking at some kind of micro generation. When you get into a situation where you're supplying energy back to the grid, you're effectively democratizing energy, but that also has an impact on your energy identity. And you can take that right down to an individual level or a business level, and right their way up to kind of multinational government level. So the whole energy industry itself is changing. And really, we don't have time, as I indicated earlier, we just don't have time for closed systems. We need to be getting policy, science, and technology and business kind of feeding into each other much more in real time. Very similar to a lot of the conversations today is how can we get all of this data flowing so that we can actually make informed decisions. This is a slide that I don't normally put up for anybody but you guys. Space-time diagrams. Fantastic. So we've currently kind of our current horizon for action, you know, our current, you know, potential futures are simply inadequate to deal with the issue. We need to start bending the space-time of policy and commerce here. We need to really start getting the data out, plugging it back in, and saying to the policymakers, this is feasible. We've taken all this information, we've turned it into knowledge, and we've turned it into models which you can then use in this next iteration of your policy, which you're going to do next month, not in 5 years, because we don't have 5 years. So, a few calls to action here. Give everything an energy identity. It's very much like giving everything a URI, very akin to the Internet of Things, very symbiotic with the Internet of Things. Building smart grid behavior into everything, so really building environmental intelligence into everything. And lobbying for and creating open standards is something we're very, very keen on doing and we need help with. So if anybody would like to help us create some open standards around this, please come and talk to me. We need to sort out data ownership before the fact. I was just handed this article just before I came on stage, which is British Gas are going to create 2,500 green jobs to install smart meters in people's homes. And there's a consultation process on smart meters that's planned to run to September. The government would like energy suppliers to be responsible for meters with the new third-party body handling the data, but the companies want to do it all themselves. Not at all surprising. The companies want all the data. Where have you heard that before? I feel very strongly that the control of that information should very much be with yourselves. So we need to really work out all that data ownership before the fact. Just want to finish up with a couple of examples here. So this is, we've got a smart meter device here, which is spitting out that you clamp onto your electricity supply. It takes a meter reading every minute. We transform that into effectively a live carbon intensity value every minute. So you can look at the actual carbon intensity of what you're doing at home. But what's coming out of these smart meters now is also device identification. And it's not just a device identification that says, based on the overall electricity consumption kind of wave pattern in your main meter, that your cooker's gone on or your fridge has gone on. It's that a Zanussi's fridge has gone on and it's got a faulty motor, or that it's a Sony TV that's gone on. It went on for 30 minutes between 6 and 9 p.m. So there's a whole range of issues. You can imagine that information being very useful to Sony, for example. How are people using our televisions? So we're starting to see other unintended or possibly intended consequences of this data. So that's me. I think there's an awful lot of stuff under the hood here, and I just really want to kind of open that out to as many questions as possible. And I believe as well, Etienne, who was going to be doing a demo after this of one of a device that does this kind of thing called AlertMe, isn't able to make it, so I can maybe cover up on some of that as well. Thank you.
Great, thanks very much. There's obviously a lot of ideas thrown out there, lots of things to think about. So what we're going to do is just take 15 minutes or so for short questions, clarification points, that kind of thing, to the panel. And then after that, we'll open it up to a broad discussion where you can make longer comments and you'll have time to do that. So there's not a roving microphone, so if you've got a question or a quick clarification, then if you want to shout out, that's brilliant. If not, then come to the front and we can give you the microphone. And can you guys use that microphone machine? Is that
sure.
One?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, yeah, we have. Sorry, if you just hold on a second. If anyone's leaving, can you do so quietly and quickly?
Okay, my question is about location and the other question is that if we need to get a flight, did you do any research about
Okay, so for those of who didn't hear all of that, the question was, what can you determine, especially where your boss is concerned, when you lie about your location or where you go underneath the radar? The answer is that there's been a reasonably large amount of research done about people's behavioural patterns. The way in which the location systems that we use were developed was actually location came in later on. The underlying pinning of Fire Eagle was predominantly a privacy system. It just happened to be expressed through that of location. The idea, though, of fine granularity for different applications, being able to switch on and switch off, being able to lie, being able to temporarily subvert the system, was built as a platform first and foremost. And one of the easiest ways and one of the best ways that we foresaw of actually getting that platform in use was to use it for location, because at the time GPS was starting to go mainstream. You had more and more phones turning up with GPS chips within them, and so on and so forth. Is there anything which can be derived from going under the radar? Yes, I'm sure there is. However, I think it's worth bearing in mind that by and large, people are creatures of habit. So if you're in the habit of going under the radar in one way, you're not necessarily going to change that when you undertake a new form of technology. Whether or not you've got a paranoid boss is another thing entirely.
Okay, great. Has anyone else got some comment for that on the panel? No? Okay. So we'll take this guy at the front here and then yourself, and then at the back, and then I'm taking notes for you, don't worry. So go ahead.
If you know where I am all the time, and if you know my energy usages, and if for some reason I offend some sensibility or harm the critical system, am I then to expect sanctions? And how immediately might those be?
Okay, if you just hold off on that one a second, we'll take the next two as well, very quickly, short ones, please.
Okay. Going into the issues of sort of privacy and lying, if you are, this is a piece of information that wasn't available to everyone. So if you're now, you're effectively going, right, I'm now going down the path of things and I'm happy with my boss knowing my location for the rest of the time, but that bit, I don't want to. And so you're consistently having to create lines. Can you see that actually changing society and people are consistently having to, previously your boss just wanted to know, and it wouldn't matter. If you're consistently having to generate lines, that
will
change the people.
Right, okay, and at the back there?
Yeah, I mean, and sort of similarly, really with that is it going to become, if it becomes to the fault that you either have to lie or that you know, everyone knows where it is it going to get to a stage where the very fact that you decide not to do that, or you switch it on, is obviously significant in some way, and, you know, you get considered well, so why do you turn it off again? You must have something to hide. Is that, you know, now?
Sorry, there's like a big queue now, and you got a chance to say yours, so you can clarify at the end if there's time. Did you guys all get those questions, or do you want me to recap?
Yeah, okay. If I can, I'll do a quick one on all three. I think, the sanctions piece, there has been a lot of talk about carbon rationing, so that you actually get given an allocation at the beginning of the year, and that's what you get to spend, but how would you monitor that? And I think, the thing is, the technology exists to provide that level of monitoring at the moment. I think it's, political suicide for the government, any government trying to introduce such a measure, because it would be met with such vehement opposition, shall we say. But we do need to take control of that kind of space ourselves. And, my call to action really is that if we take control of that space, because we're kind of first to market with it, we understand this technology much better than anyone else, and we can bring it to market in a way that's much more in the hands of the individual and in the hands of the user, then we might be able to simulate change in a more effective way that we actually want to engage with, rather than someone that just comes along and sticks an extra tax on us for, using up too much energy or something. I think on the persistent lying change in society thing, I think we're already seeing evidence of that in recent conferences I've been at. I've been very aware, and panelists and speakers are very aware, that when you give a presentation now, it's not just a thing that you say to the room, it's a thing that gets rebroadcast, retweeted, filmed, podcast, etc., around the world, and is archived forever. So you change the way that you present, you change the things that you say. So I think that's already having an effect on society, because it's that's at a very personal level what everyone is doing. And the switching off question, yes, I think, a 1984 type scenario of like, why did you switch off your intercommunication device? Is extremely likely.
Just a quick comment that really addresses all three questions. the sentiment from the questioner seems to be that there's a kind of binary on or off. You're either saying something publicly or you're not saying something at all. And if you look at some applications like LiveJournal, like Points, which I know is not shut, but it's possible to direct updates to a subset of the people who pay attention to you. And I think that an increasing number of applications are going to support something other than kind of 100% broadcast to those people who follow you.
Okay. On the taking sanctions against you side of things, I think we need to sort of bear in mind that all of this is predominantly opt-in. Therefore, the default state for people to view your behavior is where you don't actually have that information. With regards to the lying and the switching off, well, you know what, guys? We already have that at the moment. You switch your television set off at night, which means that audience tracking can't determine whether or not you've been watching a popular program. I don't know about you lot, but I switch my mobile phone off at night because the last thing I want is a call from work at 3 a.m. If work's going to give me a mobile phone which stays on all the time, they're going to have to pay me in order to be on call. So my default state is at certain hours of the day, I'm not going to be contactable. And I generally update my location during the working day because I'm quite happy to share that information while I'm at work, while I'm wandering around London, or when I'm lucky enough to be abroad. But when I'm at home, well, that's kind of my castle. It's the old Englishman's home is his castle theme. I don't necessarily want that information to be made public, and that's quite all right. And I don't think anything untowards is necessarily going to be drawn by that. We already have behaviours where you're not giving the full story. It depends whether or not you told your mates you went to the pub last night. It's the same principle. It's just in a digital format.
Okay, thanks very much. So the next three questions, short questions and comments. Remember that we will move on to having longer time for, you know, more pointed and longer comments yourself. So we'll take you here first, the blue shirt at the back, and then return to the red there. Thanks.
Just a question for Gavin Scott. You showed a bunch of examples of seeing your own data in relation to more of your own data, but I didn't see anything there that allowed me to see what that means in terms of the rest of the world, what that actually means. What does half the time mean to you? I have no idea. How does that affect the world?
Sorry, can we do the same thing and wait for the three questions? That'd be great, thanks.
So in the discussion on privacy, you made the assumption that we have a right to privacy, and I'm just wondering, would we have a better society if everybody wasn't going to be lying and so on as to make didn't actually have this right to privacy? For instance, if your energy identity was permanent, then everybody else knew that would be a strong incentive to minimize your energy. Why does that right to privacy?
Okay. Okay, well, in that case, we'll move over to the gentleman here. Yep.
I was going to make a point that technical opt-in, the whole point of the privacy issue is that you can technically opt in to something like that, something that it's more about social pressure than great, but the pressure people can opt in. I mean, I had a better point for that.
Okay.
Because I think it's just very technocratic to see that by having an opt-in option.
You mean you don't believe in a post-scarcity technocracy? I thought that was what Star Trek's all about.
Okay, we'll just take the answers to those first two and then we'll return to the floor.
Okay, so your footprint versus other people, this is something we launched just last week, last Friday, actually, with the version 2 of the Act on CO2 calculator. You can get to the end of that and compare yourself with people like you. So you can say, you know, what's my footprint versus people in a similar kind of demographic to me in terms of house size, region, et cetera, et cetera. So that information is gradually starting to emerge. Now we've got a degree of robustness and transparency around the way that the data is being collected and the way that it's being calculated, which actually didn't really exist before. Does that answer that question? Or?
Not really. I was more wondering about, I mean, even if I can compare myself with everyone else in this room, I still don't know what all of us in this room, how that affects.
Yeah, I think the one one of the easiest ways I've found to think about it is to think about, you know, that if we want to have 6 billion people on the planet, let alone 9 billion people, the average emissions per person should be 2 tons or less per annum. Right? So if you're currently emitting 5 times that through your lifestyle, and you know, we've got a whole bunch of actions and kind of guidance that come out of in response to the kind of questionnaires that we push out, it's how are we going to go through that step change? Now, this needs to happen at every single level of society, and it's happening at an industrial level, at a sort of country level, where they're mandating and, you know, literally mandating policy to push down the energy production piece. So, in theory, they shouldn't be opening any more coal-fired power plants, even though the US and the UK keep signing them off. The next impact is looking at how we produce things. How do we become much more efficient? How do we shift from a product-based economy to a service-based economy? And I think our role in this kind of digital space and creating value out of digital interactions, it plays a really key role in that transformation of value. And then it comes right down to us as individuals of how do we actually reduce our travel, change the way that we operate, and actually consume less stuff. That requires all of those tiers of activity concurrently.
So there were two further questions. One was on full transparency, and the third was, your question's repeated out. Do you want to give a fuller version of it, or? Okay. So in terms of the full transparency stuff, I think there are good psychological reasons why having some sort of semi-secret states between individuals is a good idea. For example, buying someone a birthday present. It's a good idea not to tell them what it is before they actually get the present. It's a very trivial example, but there are many other states in which you wish to withhold information from someone, possibly to protect them or possibly to allow something else to develop. But also, if you view the internet as purely the means of transmission of information, 90% of the world's information or more, maybe 99% of the world's information, isn't on the internet, so you will never get to a fully transparent state. So you need to design systems which allow direct communication of information and broadcast of information.
So on the full transparency point, I'll admit, I think you've got a point. I don't necessarily think as the social animals that we are now, the human race is quite ready to have every single piece of dirty laundry aired in public. There is a need for privacy, a need to be able to shut the world off. But on a significantly large amount of things, there is a compelling model. I mean, given the recent hoo-ha over our wonderful elected members of parliament's expenses, you compare and contrast that with the US, where all of the receipts for senators' expenses have been made available under their Freedom of Information Act for something in the region of 20 years. And pretty much as soon as the net started to gain critical mass, they were made available. The incidence of expenses fraud within the US is virtually zero. Admittedly, you've got the other side where it costs an arm and a leg and you have to hawk your kidneys on eBay just to stand for election in the first place. But the fact is that, let's try that again. The fact is that there is a need for public life, I think, for transparency, and a default position of having that there is very, very important. Whether that applies to our personal lives, my view is I don't think we're ready for that.
Great. Okay, so there's the guy in the white here and then in the blue behind him afterwards, and then we'll take yourself, and then once you've responded to those ones, we'll open it up for the larger comments.
Thank you. So I guess transparency and discussion is only about media politicians, less politicians. But the whole idea of transparency is sort of a utopian absence of food and food. And for example, take a contact point database for children. It seems to be, as a young person today, I have no way of forgetting my little bag of things, such as spill my
Does it? something bigger than merely but not having a fair and equitable place in what's going on.
So what's the question?
I think I understood.
How does one move from this utopian discussion of transparency to the reality of who and who?
Okay. Great. Yourself? There'll be time for like longer comments, and I'll let you go afterwards. But if you have a particular question or clarification, we can make that now.
We seem to have a sort of conflation on two different things earlier. Of course, it's turning off the location, so nobody gets the information, and then can't try to line up the location, so it actually says I'm on the corner when actually you're somewhere else. And you can see uses for both essentially. One is lying, the other is.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And finally, yourself.
How is AD funded? Is it going to use the information it gathers for any commercial purpose?
Okay, do you want to...
That's an easy one. Yeah, so AIMEE is a private company. We're funded by O'Reilly and Union Square Ventures, who are the funders behind Twitter, as well as a couple of UK investors. We are, a commercial business, but we operate the business as a service. So it's a platform as a service, effectively. So we don't explicitly license any data. We explicitly mandate that our customers own their data. We don't own their data, and we also mandate that they have to explicitly opt in to any aggregate, anonymized benchmarking, etc., that we might do with that information at a later date. So if you go into the Google Gadget, for example, and enter your information, the data is stored in AIMEE. First of all, we've got an anonymous key between us and Google, so we don't have your name or email address or anything like that. Secondly, it's Google's data and subject to the end user license agreement that they have with you.
It wasn't the privacy concern I was concerned about, it was more about how you're kind of making money from things.
Sure, we charge a service fee to our customers, so the government through to Radiohead through to Morgan Stanley, etc., pay a service fee for access to the platform. Much like Basecamp, Yeah, so they use data warehousing, analytics, to describe it in much more kind of dry terms. Yeah, it's a very straightforward kind of software service.
I think with this sort of full transparency utopia, we've gotten away from the original point a little bit. I don't doubt that there are a lot of benefits to be had by some form of staggered transparency, and location is just one of the multitude of facets which it's okay to give that information up, and it's also okay to control access to that information. But I think we shouldn't forget that the one of the key things I hope I said in my deck was the fact that there's this move away from having a default position where that information is exposed, back to a position where if you want to avail yourself of these facilities, you've got to physically do something in order to enable that. Unless the government suddenly decides that it's going to mandate tracking for every single GPS chip within the country, you're always going to have the ability to say no. And I don't think society, your friends, your family, your bosses are going to read too much into the fact that you choose not to avail yourself of that service.
Just another quick point on transparency. I don't think 100% transparency will ever happen. Hands up, who will tell me their salary and shout it out to the audience now? Okay, well done. But virtually no one in the audience, there's two people put their hands up, and yourself. So there are certain levels of information that we regard as private. We might tell our friends, but this stuff that will always, I think, remain private, secrets between friends, will continue to exist.
Wait a second, you're diving right ahead of me, because I'm just about to say that now we can move on to having longer comments, and feel free to not have a question and just say what you think, and after you do that, at the end we'll go back, and the speakers will be taking a few notes, and they will have a few minutes to reply to you. because you might be talking for a bit longer, it would be great if you could come to the microphone a little bit. So I'll jump down here.
I was offered a replacement speaker for the final session. So if you'd like me to speak, I can do so. I was told to do this 30 minutes ago. Or if you'd rather not hear a bit of ill-prepared material.
Well, do you want, I mean, it's not really up to me, but it's... would you like to introduce yourself? Would you, would you like to stand up there, or do you want to stay down here? Which would you rather?
Okay. Unless you
really
want to go upstairs to stay.
Okay, whilst, I'm going to pass the microphone over, but whilst you're doing that, if people want to raise their hands, and I'll nod at you when I've taken you down to speak. Great.
So Etienne, I think, was due to be here from Alertme. I don't know Etienne. I was, however, the first employee at Alertme and took it through for 2.5 years after we shipped product. And I'm now working for Serious Change, which is a not-for-profit group, and we're trying to figure out how to get Britain zero carbon as soon as possible. So I'm totally unqualified to talk randomly about smart meters, but that was what I was told you wanted to hear. So. I wanted to tell you a little bit about what smart metering is. Do any of you know anything at all about smart meters? If I asked any of the people to put your hands up to define a smart meter, could you do it? Oh, that's a pretty good audience. Okay, so you're already very educated, so you probably don't need me to tell you, but smart meters are going to do a lot of different things, and there is no one standard definition at the moment. Everyone means something different by the term. So it can be something which measures the whole of your electricity, gas, water consumption for your property, and bear in mind that could be a home or a business. It can be something that communicates to some kind of regional or central database in real time exactly what's going on with your readings. It might be something that can, as Gavin mentioned, automatically detect what appliances you've got in your home and report that, because that's always very exciting. It might be something that displays to you, the consumer, what your house is doing, what your energy usage is, and you can get quite a lot of those today. Gavin had a picture of a current cost OWL ElectroSave kind of unit, which is very popular, very cheap. You can get one now. There's lots of others out there. DIY Kyoto make a Watson unit, and there's loads of others starting to appear. So displays that just tell you what's going on. But I would say the display is not really a smart meter. It's just giving you the information you could have got by looking in your cupboard. Smart meters might be able to turn stuff on and off automatically. If you take away the idea of a meter as being a box in your cupboard and start to imagine it being a distributed system of electronics around your house, it could do a lot more. It might be built into your sockets, it might be built into your plugs, it might be something that you plug your appliances through, or it might be built into the appliances. Something that can say, okay, this is a fridge, but right now I'm going to... I'm using my microphone, I'm probably standing too close to the speakers. It can decide to turn things off. It can say, okay, this TV has been left on standby overnight, I'm automatically going to turn it off for you. Or it could say, electricity usage in your region is particularly high today. I'm going to turn the thermostat in your fridge down a little bit, up a bit, because you don't really need to keep all your stuff quite as cold as you've been thinking. So it might be able to make automatic decisions on your behalf. It might be something that notifies you if you're away from home or whether you're at home of particularly unusual usage, which could be high or it could be low. If you're monitoring an elderly person in their home, unusually low electricity usage might be a sign that they're not boiling the kettle and they might need some extra help. So lots of different things that smart meters could do. They could also, that's another good point, if you are doing microgeneration, solar, whatever, it might be able to record that as what you feed back into the grid if you're doing anything particularly useful like that. The main reason why I would say Britain needs smart meters and everyone else needs smart meters isn't particularly for you as the individual consumer. If you care about your electricity at home, you can go and buy a little display today. You can figure out which each appliances are using by turning them on and off, watching your display. You can make sure you turn your TV off every night, don't leave it on standby. There's a lot of things you can do really quickly without having a smart meter. Smart meters enable the greater good. They enable a whole country to get more reliable electricity supply. So, as of today, we're getting quite close to the usage of electricity in the UK pretty much matching the supply at certain times. So when we all go, the traditional example, we all go and turn the kettle on after Coronation Street, the electricity usage suddenly goes up, and we have to hope we have enough generational capacity to meet that need. With smart meters and a smart grid of smart meters that are measuring everything that's going on and communicating either in regions or nationally, aggregating all this data in real time, we can actually do more intelligent things. We can start to watch when demand peaks for no particular reason, and maybe we can start to turn off those non-essential appliances at that time. Or we might decide to charge a bit more at that time and let you know as a consumer by a text message or a red light in your house or something, hey, electricity just went up a bit. or we could automatically turn things off. These are all different options, and no one knows quite what's going to happen in this space. Alternatively, you could decide that some things doesn't matter when they charge. So for instance, if I'm leaving my electric car on the drive overnight, I don't care at what point it charges as long as it's charged by the morning. So if the smart grid can figure out the best time when the power is most likely to be coming from a renewable source and not from a coal-fired power station, then that's really cool, and that would be a really great benefit to the smart grid. The thing to bear in mind here is that renewables tend to give very peaky power. If you're looking at wind, it depends on there being wind. If you're looking at solar, that can be quite peaky as well, compared to oil and coal-fired power stations, which can traditionally operate at a much more level basis. And peaky power, if the wind suddenly drops, your generational capacity drops, then you're going to either need to dial down the demand a little bit or bring online your emergency nuclear power station or whatever. By having intelligence throughout the grid, sensors measuring demand at every point, every business, every property, collating all that data, measuring trends, predicting what's going on, we can actually start to use renewables more efficiently. But just to make the point about data, there's a huge challenge here because that means every piece of power that you use in your home and all the information about the appliances you're using is going to be out there somewhere, whether it's living with Amy, whether or not we think that a commercial company is a good thing for in our data, or whether it's living with our government, or whether it's living with NPower, or whether it's fully public. These are really big challenges. Just as an example, I have a lot of home automation systems at home from a lot of different suppliers, including AlertMe. I would recommend you check them out. They're terrific. I'm a shareholder. That's my disclaimer. And some of the earliest people who've had their homes online, publicly sharing data about their homes, it seems like they would be advocates for transparency, but they're not. Almost all of them, particularly Andy Stanford Clark, who's an IBM guy, his house Twitters what's going on. All kinds of his systems are connected to the internet. But you don't actually see the real tweets. You see some of them, but he fakes a lot of it as well, because he doesn't want a burglar to come by on a day when it seems like he's not at home. So have a think about what people would be able to do with all the data from your house and all the things you do there, whether your rooms are heated or not, all that kind of thing, and whether or not you'd be happy with that going out. For the greater good, for our ability to adopt renewables, it's going to have to go somewhere. Who do you want to have looking after that data? If you have any strong opinions, get together and look up the government consultation on smart meters, which is happening right now, and go tell them what you think. There's some really amazing people right now trying to get groups together to put in official responses, and I'm really pleased to see the design community have been pulling together to put in a response to make sure smart meters are fully accessible in user interfaces. You, Dan?
Yeah.
You are? Dan, wave. He's wonderful. I follow Dan on Twitter. I don't know him at all, but he's organizing things to try to get a really good response into the smart meters consultation. So if you have any opinions on the data side, it would be good to get those going in too.
Fantastic, thank you. Okay, so there's a few comments, and you'll have up to 2.5 minutes or so each. Would you like to go first? And whilst you're speaking, again, if anyone wants to make themselves known to me that you want to have a word, then that's fine.
Oh, okay, right. I just was curious about people's views as to the responsibility of that comes with sampling your stream of consciousness, because, and that was a lot of what you seem to be talking about. And I think one issue or potential worry I have with sampling stream of consciousness is that it's a disruptive activity. I mean, there's a kind of sound neurological basis for thinking that, you know, that happens as you kind of, so when you kind of resolve events in your stream of consciousness into kind of descriptions and kind of sample points, if you see what I mean, you'd better be sure that the kind of the language that you're describing in is rich enough that it doesn't kind of flatten the experience. And I think and you can also see that the brain is quite vulnerable in terms of memory to subsequent revision of experience. So I mean, my worry is that as we increase the resolution at which we're sampling our stream of consciousness, we're in danger of kind of flattening it by resolving it into a very simplistic language. And I just wonder what people's views are on the responsibilities of creators of software to create the rich and the kind of the most high resolution language possible to kind of represent these things. And I mean, you know, things like favoriting and rating, they're incredibly low resolution compared to how we tend to think about these things internally. And I wonder whether that's damaging and what people think about that. So,
great. Thanks very much. Yourself next. Do you want the microphone or?
Yeah, very briefly. Yeah, coming back to, you know, would people in this room care to share their income? The government knows already, and we can't avoid telling them. And I'm not that sure about what the response would be when the NHS discover that I spend 6 hours a night down the pub 5 days a week. Not that I do, but were I one of those people, would I really be keen that the NHS would know, or indeed my boss would know, or my health insurance company would know, or my income protection company would know? You know, it just seems to me that there's a lot of possibilities, and when disclosure or information gathering by authorities who claim that they're gathering the information for the greater good, I suddenly feel very small, very alone, and very threatened, but maybe I'm just paranoid.
Thanks very much. Okay, next up.
Okay, totally unrelated to my forgotten point earlier. This is mainly for Gavin, although one... I was speaking at a conference at the Energy Institute recently, and we were talking about Google Street View and carbon footprints and thermographic imaging of buildings, and thought, wouldn't it be fab, apart from the fact that everyone would go crazy if you did it, if you did a Google Street View with thermographic images of everyone's house, you've instantly got there. You could just like look down your street and say, hang on, look at those people on the grand knock on their door and say you need to insulate your walls or whatever. But
it's all cannabis farms.
Sorry? It's all cannabis farms. That would be that. You could also have the Amy footprint data above it.
Smart metering.
So I think, my first question, which kind of comes off that a bit, is just how much people are developing interesting tools around Amy. So I, for our office, I bought one of the current cost CT128 meters and have been, at some point when I actually have the time, because it's going to be like more of a hobby than a part of my job, hook that up through Amy and Patch Bay and others and try and make that work. But it's all at the moment quite, you know, alpha geek tools. So are you doing anything to help a developer, sort of community of developers, or is there any sort of initiative to get more people to be able to use these tools? And the second question is around data. So I've been talking with Jamie, your colleague, about Stockholm Environment Institute's REAP engine. There are lots of other data. There's loads of data out there in the environmental field, and it's all locked up either behind proprietary agreements or just very bad formats. When Amy came along, when I first heard about it, I thought that's brilliant, but it's quite... I mean, although it's got the Act 1 CO2 link and BRE and others have used it, it's still quite limited in that it's only looking at a sort of small chunk of things that generate carbon. It's not looking at, you know, there's so many other data sets out there. I'm just wondering how you're getting on in terms of talking to those other data providers to persuade them to come in. Because your thing about saying we haven't got time to faff around hiding it is absolutely right, but still, you know, people are remarkably resilient to common sense.
Would it be okay if you waited to the end? Because, obviously...
Forget them. I'm losing.
Well, that's why I said you should be taking notes. I did say... I'm sorry, I've got to let the people speak here. If you jump up and make some notes, and then you'll have time at the end to come back on everyone's points together.
My problem with all the geolocation data and Facebook and things like that is you cannot be both Bruce Wayne and Batman. You can't lead a duplicitous life. And I think we need multiple personalities on these things. I think turning it on or off or lying, I don't think that's the answer. I think we need a better way of granularizing and filtering specific profiles for specific people and filtering people in and out of your friend group and things like that. I was wondering what Yahoo and other firms are doing to address that.
Okay, I just had a couple of comments. I think actually the new generation of people who've grown up with Flickr and Facebook actually have a much lower expectation of privacy, and they regard photographs on Facebook as, you know, much less damaging to their future careers simply because it's just that much more normal to them. However, I think a certain degree of privacy is a basic element of human psychology, and complete disclosure of everything is always going to be... only for certain individuals who really are pushing their lives as a public part of the public space. That's why the sort of live journal model, which when people start using it, they really stay with it, is a very good one, where you disclose some things to some people, you show vague data to a larger set and precise data only to certain chosen sets of people.
Now everyone knows is Dan.
Some of these things, because even with notes, it's going to be very difficult to keep context.
Okay, yeah, no, that's absolutely fine, but that's why I said at the beginning, if anyone's got any questions, can you do them then? And then if anyone's got any comments, can you do them afterwards? So I'm sorry about that confusion, but... No, that's absolutely fine. What I'll say then is, could you, if anyone does have questions, could you make that clear? And if you have a comment, could you also make that clear? Because it'd be easier for me to facilitate then. Okay, so in that case, we'll pass straight over.
Can the panelists respond, please, to the points that are
yeah, that's,
clear the
that's,
audience like that?
That's just what I'm saying. I'm just clarifying it to everyone because it seems that some things were misunderstood before. So, yeah. So now I'm going to say... Go first, because there was a question earlier just to you.
Okay.
I agree with you. It's
just... So, in reverse order, so there was a question about developer community. Generally, Amy, this time last year, Amy had 2.5 people working on it part-time with quite a substantial kind of user base. We got funded tail end of last year. We've now got 18 people. So we are working very hard to support more and more. In terms of the model supported, we've now got, this time last year we had Act on CO2 and a couple of other models, so maybe a couple of thousand object models, if you like. Now we've got 23,000 object models, including things like SAP, which is the thing that does energy performance certificates in the UK. So if you do want to do an energy assessment of your home, you can use Amy to do that. It's another great example of a whole 2 million home database that's locked up in some system that nobody knows who owns the rights. We've also got materials like concrete and stuff like that. So, and we've got data for 150 countries and state level data in the US and a whole bunch of stuff.
What data, for different countries?
Electricity factors, heating, air conditioning, a bunch of stuff.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So we've had a busy team and we've got an infinite list. So yes, we'd love the community to get more involved, and we'd love to be helping the community more. It's one of the big things on our to-do list. Big Brother State, effectively, was your question I wrote down. It's kind of like, what do we do about all this stuff? And I totally agree, and it's why I think to invoke the Danny O'Brien moment probably is, I'd love to see the kind of data being pushed out to the edge, being managed by individuals, and then being shared back into the cloud, as it were. That would be my ideal. I think what we've tried to do with Amy is provide as much as that function. We're not dissimilar in terms of the way that we're approaching this data. We're very similar to Fire Eagle in terms of the kind of model that we've got around ownership of data and how it gets shared. But yeah, I completely agree with you on, there's a lot of, I think one of my big concerns in this entire space is it's very like early web days. There were lots and are lots of unintended consequences of what we're doing, which we don't yet know what the questions are. And this is why when I set up Amy, I said, okay, well, first thing we're going to do is anonymize the data. Then we're going to insist that our clients own it and that we don't take ownership in that by automatically. And we kind of tried to preempt as many of the things that I was aware of from my kind of experience in the digital space as I could, in terms of these are the models that I think are the ones that need to work in this emerging space.
I just wanted to address a couple of the points raised. The joining up of various databases, discovering information, data mining, scares the bejesus out of me. Smart meters scare the bejesus out of me. Not because I think the idea behind them is flawed, not because I think they're necessarily a bad thing, but our history over the last 100 years have shown that the thing which matters the most is money. Large corporations. A smart meter from the electricity company may well show me when I'm using too much electricity, but I can guarantee that those will not be put into homes without some form of channel from the various electricity generating companies. And the last thing I want to see is I'm having a party. So 2 weeks ago, it was my daughter's second birthday party, and we had a massive birthday party. We burn every single light in the house. Do I really want the electricity company to say, I'm sorry, you've exceeded your capacity, and they switch the power off? Or alternatively, they suddenly jack me up to a higher tariff and I really do pay through the nose. I think access to utilities such as power, water, sanitation, sewage are pretty much human rights. And I feel very, very uneasy about giving somebody the right to control my access to that. The other point I wanted to very briefly touch on was I think a point that you made. Do you want to quickly reiterate your statement for me? The one which you were standing up.
About future generations, or?
Yeah.
Well, it's simply an observation that societal norms are changing, that people have grown up with their pictures being on Facebook from age one through their college years and so on. I mean, Barack Obama admitted freely that he smoked dope and tried cocaine, and it didn't really damage his chances because people just thought he was being honest. It's like, you know, year 1900, the advice was masturbation will turn you blind. By 1980 or so, they were saying, you know, everyone does it, it's normal. And sort of adolescent experimentation with cocaine or whatever is also seen as relatively normal. It's a forgivable fault because now there's the evidence that it's so common.
Okay, so I don't think we've seen the impact of the Facebook generation yet. I mean, personally, when I'm interviewing staff, I look at their LinkedIn profile. I don't look at their Facebook stuff. I don't look at their Flickr photo stream. I don't look at their Twitter stream. I don't really give a toss if they got their dick out and somebody took a photograph of it. Does that impair their ability to do a job? I don't think so. But I'm probably not the average person when it comes to making those sort of statements. And I can guarantee that people now who are in their teens, who are playing with social networking and photo posting and linking all that together, some of them are going to pay the price for that in about 5 to 10 years when they come out of college and they're looking for a job. And the reason they don't get the job is because there's a photo of them on Facebook from 10 years ago after far, far too many beers. I mean, come on, we've all been there. It's just the possibility now exists for that to come and haunt you for a considerable period of time. That's why I hark back to my commentary about things like this. They need to be opt-in, not opt-out. If you want your future boss to see your stuff on Facebook, you need to be able to grant him access, not for him to have the default access, which means that people need to be a little bit careful. They need to have a degree of common sense when they do this. And this, hey, let's social media everything, is deeply refreshing. But I'm not convinced that the generation who are carrying this out are best placed to make the moral decisions on how best to do that.
Let's pick up on them in the kind of that order. So the idea that norms change, I think that is true. I think, though, that the people who've been playing around with Facebook and things like that, it's been around for about 8 years. Well, Facebook's been around for 5 years. Things have been around, so there isn't really a whole generation there yet. The people who will be their hiring managers in whatever company haven't had that experience. So I'm 38. And basically, if you're older than me, then you didn't get access to the web at university, and you went to university. So around about 93. If you're younger than me, then you probably had access to the web at university. So there's a kind of cultural inversion point around about my age. Those people think about the world in a different way because they've had ready access to the web for a longer period of time. It took probably another 5 or 10 years for broadband to become mainstream in the UK. So it was around about early 2000 that broadband started to become readily available in the UK, where the internet started to become your default reference point as opposed to books and telephones. So you get these kind of 5 to 10 year shifts in cultural outlook, and they pepper kind of the employment landscape from people who've just left university or just left college right the way up to people who are at retirement age and have very different cultural outlooks. So I think you're right. I think that the impact of the Facebook generation is to come, but that we'll see it in different echelons, because 60-year-olds tend not to hire 18-year-olds. 20 and 30-year-olds tend to hire 18-year-olds. So you tend, because of the seniority shift that happens. We talked a little bit about multiple friends lists. One of the things I've seen happening on Twitter is people having multiple Twitter accounts. So they have one for friends and they have one for public. That's reasonably common. I probably know about 20 or 30 people who have that. So we're starting to see people trying to use tools where there aren't these privacy controls and creating them for themselves. Always leads to amusing incidents where people forget which one they're Twittering on, but that happens anyway. Yep. The whole kind of paranoia, public data, private data thing, I think the most significant aspect for that, for me in that area, is kind of healthcare insurance, particularly in America. Any data that's public in America, the healthcare insurance companies seem to view as fair game for them to use against you. And it seems very much the health insurance in America is against you. One of the things I know that the UK government did in 1994 was ensure that the national insurance number wasn't used as the sole means of indexing data against people throughout the UK. I'm not sure if that's still true, but in 1994, when the Data Commissioner role was created, they were very concerned about the idea of a single government organisation or a single commercial organisation with access to that data being able to aggregate and index all of the data about an individual across every single government database. So they made different government departments use different unique keys. Obviously, all you have to do is get the different unique keys, but they've made it slightly harder. And then the last point about kind of richness, stream of consciousness, made me think a lot about some of the science fiction I'm reading at the minute. This idea is that, you know, at some point, these devices will be in our heads. There will be some sort of cybernetic thing, probably not for a couple of hundred years, but the idea that what we're doing at the minute decreases the richness of that activity, that wasn't quite the point I was making. The fact that you can favorite a picture increases, and through a single mouse click, increases the likelihood that you will do it. People are much less likely to tag another person's photographs compared to favoring another person's photographs. So although you do lose richness, you gain a huge amount more expression.
Yes, but what I'm asking is it worth it given that...
I'm really sorry to say, but time's running short, and the reason that we said we'll go to the floor and then go back and not go back one at a time is because what's going to happen is that the three panellists who've spoken quite a lot will end up speaking even more, and there's people here who want to speak. And so what I am going to say is that we'll take three more comments from the floor and then go back and you can have your responses, but could you please keep those responses short because people want to speak. Okay, so... Great, okay, so then we have Dan, and then yourself, and then yourself, and then yourself. But we'll take the first three.
All right, thanks, I'll be quick. Sorry. Well, okay, all right, thanks. The research, I do research at Brunel on how we can design things that influence people's behaviour, so you use them in a different way. So...
You're standing for the speaker, so
sorry. I'll go ahead. What we kind of, it relates to the smart meter stuff and also to data in general is, you know, a lot of the electricity data is clearly about improving the supply side of it and improving the information that's available to suppliers so they can plan better, right? But there also seems to be an assumption that consumers or users will change their behavior just by seeing how much worse they're doing than other people or that they're using this amount of money or whatever. And I'm not sure the government's own smart meter, the consultation document, suggests that consumers will only reduce their use by 2.8%, which, you know, is a tiny amount. I mean, you could probably save more electricity by, I don't know, banning kettles or... not installing the meters in the first place, yeah. So I suppose what the point I was trying to make is there's almost two aspects to it. There's using information like this to influence the way people think and the way people behave, which is one aspect. So there's influencing user behaviour. And there's also changing the product behaviour. So if you're going to use smart meters to switch devices off or actually actively change the way the devices work, it's almost a separate issue from giving people more information about it. And I'm not sure that the way it's presented to the public at present doesn't really highlight the fact that the outcome might actually be a series of things which effectively control what you can do in your own home. And that isn't being, it's not being sold to the public in that way. It's being sold to the public as, this will help you save money, this is great, it's modern, it's digital, it's got a display, it's science, the future, and whatever. Whereas actually, quite a lot of it is probably going to be, this is so we can introduce electricity rationing in 2015. Right? Which, it may well be that. I mean, it would certainly facilitate it. So I don't know, I'm not quite sure that they're being terribly honest about it. I don't know, I just thought I should make that point.
I wouldn't assume anybody has more of a clue than
you do. No, okay. Yeah. Okay, cheers.
I assume that people are still navigating the space. One of the reasons why this forum, this very particular audience can contribute hugely to the space is saying, we've done this before, we've done this over the last 10, 15 years in the online space. We can learn, take all of that experience and all of the things that you've been talking to me about, digital privacy and online comms, and really bring that to this conversation.
Yeah, the only point I was going to say was just, yeah, it's almost like we do need, as people who are interested in technology and its effect on how we live our lives, we almost need to make it clear about what we really want. I mean, there may be people who want something which helps them manage their electricity use better, and the way of managing it might be cutting stuff off so I don't have to think about it anymore. But like, and as you made the point with the with a birthday party type scenario, I mean, people won't want, they won't let people in to install the meters if they realise that that's and it will only take one old person dying of hypothermia because, you know, the thing accidentally cut her off because she went over some predefined limit or her credit card. It's I don't know, it risks the massive public reaction, I guess, is what I'm concerned about.
People have been waiting. That's the point. So do you want to come forward and have a word?
Hello. It's basically adding to what you were just saying and kind of summary of the day. We've been hearing about code is power, data is power, in a way knowledge is power. And the whole discussion about giving people technology, we can't really control how they will use it. We can't prevent some misuse. We can't predict how they're going to use it, I think. So when we talked about today at The Guardian, the guys were showing information visualization. We talk about behavioral change, how we can do that, and I think what Bill Thompson was saying earlier is about we need to go out and educate people. The general public need to understand how data is being used. We need information visualizations that are meaningful to people. We need to explain opt-in, what are you opting in, and I see a lot of my friends coming onto Facebook now and being really excited and being totally unaware. So it's about money, and the services will not educate people. So it's us who work in organizations that make decisions, you can influence these decisions, but I see it more as us being kind of ambassadors of openness, of transparency, and we have to just tell others about it in our personal lives as well. And that was open tech for me, I guess. That's it.
Hi there, this is probably a question for the remaining few panelists. Basically, the thing I'm getting away from is that the approach of the difficulty of collecting data is approaching zero, and the benefits are extremely high. In many cases, outweighing the advantages of kind of going under the radar. How do you sell the idea of going under the radar as normal behaviour to people? Because when the benefits are that great, it's going to be really, really hard to say, actually, I don't want to disclose what I'm doing. When you're going up against like saving the planet or something else as the counter argument to that, and this is where's the language for this, because we're going to need to find this.
Do you want to take those three responses very quick and about less than a minute each, because he's got a microphone.
I think we just need to look at supermarket cards as a first step. That'd be a really good model. Just look at all the incentives around that, but there are other unintended consequences about the joining together of these disparate data sets that we need to have this kind of forum discussion on.
I think the key thing that you mentioned there was the trade-off between saving the planet and other more meaningless things. And though I think I would love to go for individual privacy, I actually would rather have a planet in 60 years which still had people on it. So,
so I have about 1,000, maybe 1,500 things that Amazon knows about and knows my preferences around them. I'm very happy to do that. I guess many other people in the room have done similar things to tune Amazon so that it recommends decent books and decent music to you. If we can build services which support, kind of have this positive outcome, then we can evoke the kind of behaviors that we want. So if we make reducing park, you know, using less electricity, traveling less, attractive as opposed to hair shirt, then I think we can drive that kind of thing. But the media latch on to particular issues like flying, like smart meters, and they push those issues, whereas we need a kind of general reduction, as Gavin was saying earlier, 20 tons to 2 tons or 10 tons to 2 tons is a huge difference. One of the interesting initiatives I saw recently was CRAGS, which is a community... Carbon Rationing Action Groups. It's a very, really interesting initiative, sort of locally embedded groups of people trying to collectively reduce their carbon together. And I think that's something that, as a community, we should be trying to do, is build social products which enable collective community action, like a community delivery service. Why on earth the Royal Mail don't provide a delivery, let their premises be used for the delivery of other packages when you're not there, so that the DHL package doesn't go back to a depot miles away, is beyond me, but...
I was interested about the supermarket loyalty card issue because in there is choice. And the thing I find very difficult to deal with is the sanguine nature of the idea that some government department deciding not to do something, or more accurately, labelling a process that we have no insight to. The use of national insurance numbers or not for cross-referencing people, it was stated as though the police national computer has never been abused. It was stated as though the National Health Service database has never been abused. It was stated as though everyone and their uncle working in local authorities doesn't have access to contact point. I mean, if we're going to have so much data knocking around, transparency is much more than me hiding the fact that, you know, I drink 3 pints of beer a day. There's got to be no more sofa cabinet. There's got to be records, there's got to be data, everyone's got to be giving all their data, particularly those who have control over us. I'm reluctant to invoke Godwin's law, but I'm about to. the IBM data cards during World War II? Yeah.
Thank you. Is there any other comments that need to be made? Sorry.
Really quick point of information. In France, when you ask for an electricity supply, you specify how many amperes it's going to be. If you exceed that by a certain amount, they double the tariff effectively. If you go over it, it's a cold night, so you put an extra couple of heaters on, the box on the wall in the street goes bang, and you have to get the man down to sort it out again. The company that does this, you probably know them as EDF. For those that aren't aware, for the UK branding, that's Électricité de France. So, there you go, guys, it already happened.
Thanks very much. Yep, do you want
to? The worrying thing is not that the IRS knows what my salary is, was, and, you know, will be, hopefully, sometime. It's that there's a good chance that they'll leave it in a briefcase on a train somewhere. As you were saying, yeah.
This final comment, and if anyone else got any burning issues, because we're running out of time, and then we'll pass back to final closing comments to the panelists. So would you like to... Anyone else make a quick final point afterwards? Great.
I was just going to say that there's an interesting cultural issue that seems relevant to this, which is the amount of effort people are willing to invest in learning new technology. And I think it's when you're capturing data implicitly, you can end up with a massive ton of data, but kind of getting people to act on it is is very difficult. And it's similar to the issue of kind of linguistic collapse, and also the fact that the levels of privacy that we have tend to be too coarse-grained in terms of, you know, either opt out or lie. I mean, if, you know, you could imagine some kind of system where you could easily express, I want this audience of my friends to know this particular thing. But in order to use such a user interface, you'd almost have to treat it as a musical instrument in terms of the amount of investment of time and effort that you'd have to make. So, I mean, there does seem to be a cultural sort of issue of this asymmetry between the implicit data that we spew out in terms of samples of our lives and how much effort we're willing to invest in technologies that allow us to process that data. And a lot of problems seem to arise from that asymmetry, and it's difficult to know what to do about it. But,
Thanks very much. We've got just 2-3 minutes left, so I would ask you to recap very briefly anything you'd like to say. Thank you.
That's just a single point, really. Most people don't change the defaults of whatever application you offer them. So if you make the default being publicly sharing of data, people will aggregate data, put it in there, and it will become public. Very, very few people play around with the Facebook privacy controls. There are a small number of Twitter private accounts. There are a small number of Flickr private accounts. And anecdotally, TypePad has a significant number of private accounts. So it depends upon how you push the product and what defaults you set around it.
And I think, just to kind of reiterate, my pattern recognition, having worked on with the kind of internet for coming on for 20 years, has been that what we're about to step into, we've spent a long time trying to work out in our digital world, and we still haven't worked it out in our digital world, and we're trying to execute something at a physical level, across countries, across multiple countries, from a granular level to a macro level, that we haven't thought through, and that we need to invest a huge amount of time and effort into. So I suppose I'd encourage everyone to either get involved in responding to the government consultations, get involved in the space, tell other people you know who are really experts in this area to get involved, because not enough people are looking at it right now. And there's an increasing number of people coming into the space, but there's some real experts in the kind of digital privacy space that need to come into this space, and we need to encourage them very strongly to come in quickly and help us in working these issues out.
I think my final point would be that, as Gavin said, climate change is a huge threat, and to tackle it in any way, there's going to be a huge number of trade-offs. They're going to range from small things like whether or not you might be happy to turn your lights off overnight, to really big things like whether you want a nuclear power station next door. And everyone has to get ready to understand and help the rest of the public understand the data, the real science and engineering data that's going to be necessary to figure out the right trade-offs to make. So if there's anything any of you can do towards helping everyone else who isn't in this room, who doesn't understand all the stuff that we've been talking about, who hasn't been working on the internet, who doesn't understand open data, then start to help everyone else, because it's going to be interesting times for all, but solvable if we try.
Great. Well, that's okay. Great. That's been a bit of a monster session. Thank you for your patience and your understanding. I think we've had some great comments from the panelists and some wonderful comments from the floor as well. Thank you very much for your time. Just to thank Gavin, Gary, and Gavin, and Laura, of course, our latecomer in. And I'm sure it's lots of conversations to continue in the bar and onwards. So thank you very much.